Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Robert Bruno, the author of What Work Is. In What Work Is, Bruno draws on 20 years of experience teaching labor history and labor studies to union members from a wide variety of occupations. The result is a distinctive exploration of how workers see the work that combines personal experiences with research, history, and other diverse sources to illuminate workers' lives in the present and envision what work could be in the future. My guest, Robert Bruno, is a professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where he also serves as director of the Labor Education Program. He is the author of Justified by Work, Identity and the Meaning of Faith in Chicago's Working Class Churches, Steelworker Alley, How Class Works in Youngstown, and Reforming the Chicago Teamsters, the Story of Local 705. Robert Bruno, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a real honor to be on the program today.
So before we get into the specifics of this book, I typically ask authors a question about what brings them to the project, but I want to broaden that question out a little bit and ask you, what brings you to labor studies?
Good question. Really, I think it's my working class upbringing. I think it's having working class parents, a father who spent almost four decades working as a unionized steel worker in Youngstown, Ohio, and my mother, who in addition to principally bearing the burden of raising myself and three younger brothers, always had paid labor, spent time working in a medical facility, worked in a factory, and for a period of time worked for pay in the home as a hairstylist and beautician. And so, all, you know, my experiences growing up were embedded in these working class communities and cultures, and all the neighbors had hourly jobs, most of them in manufacturing and in the steel industry. And once I got to a point where I could start really seriously thinking about my identity and trying to better explain the world that I had grown up in, I realized that it was going to require a turn back to this working class history and culture, and that led me to academic studies in the field of labor.
So this book draws on your experience as a labor educator. Specifically, you present students. Well, let me ask this first before we get into this. Who are the students that you taught?
Yeah. So, man, I'm really fortunate. The vast majority of the students that I've taught since my time at the university are adults. They are adults in the workforce. The vast majority are in unionized settings. They are from all industries and occupations, the vast majority earning an hourly wage, some like teachers and nurses. It can be salaried, but they really do represent the vast bulk of the folks who are taking classes at the University of Illinois in non-credit, what we call certificate and extension programs. There are undergraduates, however, who are matriculating, who I've had the pleasure of teaching, and some of them have participated in the kinds of exercises that contributed to this book. And then there is a segment of unrepresented workers, workers who are not in unionized settings, but have also taken non-credit courses with the university. And they come from different genders and different language backgrounds, nationalities, and races, political persuasions. And they're all represented in the accounts that I share in the book.
So beyond that sort of demographic information, kind of the, where they're coming from, there's another thing that your book brings alive, I think, is Some sense of who these folks are in terms of their aspirations and in terms of their beliefs about themselves. I wonder if you could characterize a little of that.
Yeah, well, that's quite a characterization. And as you can imagine, it's very rich and evocative and many layered. You know, they see themselves as people who are, you know, sort of making the world happen. They're doing essential work. They're doing dirty work. They're doing hard work. They're doing it on behalf of the people they love. They feel an interdependence with other workers. They understand how essential it is in their life. They realize that this labor is to some degree imposed on them, given the political economy that they operate in. They have to work in order to eat, but they also experience substantial intrinsic benefits from the work they do. They almost always see work as meaningful, but they do distinguish work from the boss and work from the employer and how they're treated by the employer. They often feel not seen, not heard, ignored, but they're always present in ways that sometimes take a little probing to recognize. So the physical world around them bears their imprint, but it's not obvious. You've got to kind of talk about how that's the case, and they don't see themselves as revolutionary. You know, they're not. They don't believe their demands are unreasonable, frankly. You know, but they don't want to be taken advantage of either, and so they're looking for a fair. They're looking for a fair deal, and for the most part, they find it by being part of a labor union.
So let's talk about where this book comes from. In these classes that you teach, you draw for this book on a very specific assignment, which is absolutely brilliant in its kind of simplicity. I was wondering if you could describe for our listeners what it is that generated really the bulk of what happens inside this work.
Well, I think if nothing else, Tom, in my decades of teaching, I've kind of mastered the brilliance of keeping it simple. And so what I ask them to do in every class that I teach, I give them two words, and the words are work is. And then I ask them to write a brief essay completing that statement, trying to use no more than six additional words. So they get two free words, work is, and they write it on a piece of paper. And then I ask them to complete that statement using no more than six words. And the idea is to compel them to say something simply, because I think it forces them to really think about the meaning of each word that they use. And I was inspired to use this exercise really as a result of, really two inspirations. One was NPR has for years done something called the Race Project, or the Race Card perhaps, where they did something similar. They asked people to write these very brief statements about how race left an impression on them in their life. How did they experience it? And I was just blown away by how evocative and powerful these essays were. And I got to thinking, well, yeah, I mean, race can be somewhat, all-consuming in defining the experience that a person has in America, in the same way that, you know, that gender can also. But work functions that way too. And it crosses, of course, all nationalities and all races and all gender. It seems to me, the consummate unifier is the need to do work. So I thought, well, why not ask a similar sort of question of my students? And the other was, I've always been a fan of working class poetry, and the poet Philip Levine, who was the poet laureate for a year under Barack Obama when Obama was president. And Levine had been an auto worker in Detroit, and he wrote an award-winning book, a brief volume, and called What Work Is. And in fact, the title poem is one that I like referencing and reading in class. So those two inspirations sort of came together to create this really very simple exercise, which workers have no problems doing, although they kind of, when I first tell them about it, they kind of look at me like, that's it?
Right.
I said, well, yeah, but watch what's going to happen. Let's watch what happens when a room full of people write out these six words and we start talking about it. And then the magic really does unfurl.
And it is a kind of magic, because, and those are the responses make up a good deal of what appears in this book. As you said, you know, you tell your students, wait for the magic to happen. Did you find yourself surprised by what you got back from, again, I'm asking the question in part because I you know, as a professor myself, I love these kinds of teaching tools, right? These kinds of things that generate class discussion. And about a year ago, I had the opportunity to interview Ellen Cassidy, one of the organizers of the 9 to 5 movement. And she uses, it's not exactly similar, but this idea to basically describe bad bosses, right? And so just, you know, I was teaching the book in a class this semester, and I have to tell you, I lost complete control of the room. and you know, and oddly, it was most of the students were women. And so I just kept my mouth shut and let him go. I don't know if you had a similar kind of thing when you brought this exercise up.
That's great. Well, you've given me a wonderful idea. You know, good teachers were always borrowing from other good ideas. So you asked me about surprises. You know, I've looked at thousands of these essays, and I continue to use them. And yes, I'm constantly surprised. And I keep thinking, well, I've probably read pretty much, you know, what there is to say about this. How much different can it be? And then I get something that kind of blows me away. And one that came in after the book was published, that I've since shared with people, was a worker wrote that work is doing what I adore the most. And by the way, this was a construction worker.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're kind of quintessential blue collar, middle class worker. And in this case, not only did I get an essay, but I got something that I almost never get along with the essays. Again, they turn their papers in, but this person drew a water can, you know, like, and with water pellets coming out as if they were watering their garden to make their garden grow. That's so funny. There was this image, right, along with the brief narrative, and what, you know, one of the things that seems really constant in all of the classes is that you do really get this this real strong sense of how their work you know, ties them to the world. It ties them to the community. It ties them to friends. That if you pulled that out of their lives, they would be like billiard balls, just sort of like bouncing around. There would be nothing that really, cohesively brings them together. So, you know, their work is making society possible. And one other surprising thing is I thought I might have gotten more responses that seemed to link them to a particular employer. And I do ask them who they work for or on whose behalf. Or one of the big themes in the book is the subject that they work for, on whose behalf they work for. And I thought I might see more references to particular employers. But I think there's one out of the thousands, meaning they really didn't see themselves working for the person who's signing their check. You know, they didn't have that connection. It was to a lot of other things, and people, but, you know, not the employer.
It's interesting. So you can see yourself as an auto worker, but it doesn't really attach you to General Motors.
Yeah. And there would have been a time where I think earlier in the 20th century, maybe in the early part of the Industrial Revolution or Fordism unfolding in America, where there would have been that more powerful connection to the employer. And then after World War II, with the expansion of the American middle class, when workers were experiencing, you know, the 40-year, if you will, career, that you were going to have a job for a lifetime, and you can say, well, you know, I worked in this plant, and my daughter and my son worked in this plant, and because this facility was here, the community grew. There was that sense of identity. You might have, but in the last couple of decades, since I've been sort of doing this work, that connection seems to really have dissipated, and it's probably a statement of the kind of rapacious capitalism that's unfolded, right? Since the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, that's interesting. So let's get into the actual work here. So the book is structured around five themes that you kind of see emerging out of these six word essays, and the responses to that idea, what work is. So let's look at each of these. In what ways does work structure workers' sense of time?
You know, time seems, the way time ends up being experienced, it's always in units, really, of being on the clock. So we have this idea that you put in your workday and then you leave that behind, and then there's time, 8 hours for what you will, right? 8 hours for play, study, what have you. But based on the essays, and there were sort of multiple ways to think about time, it really became clear that it wasn't in the we didn't they didn't experience time as the normal, you know, measurement, the normal unit, you know, 60 minutes that's sort of neutral, and it's not filled with any meaning. But they saw it as, I'm on the clock, I'm working, I'm then leaving work, and then I'm prepping to go to work, and then there's decisions I have to make when I'm not working, but it's still work that's governing that time. And even if I've got vacation time, it's because I had a lot of work time. So it's really all consuming. And they don't really see it as ending, but if it's going to end, they have to get enough of it. They have to put enough time in now so that there's some time for them not to be working. And it just, you know, it really does strike me that their greatest sense of control over their life and the degree that they have a real sense of liberty and freedom really is a product of how much time work takes up, right? It's not just, as I use my father as an example in one case, it isn't just the 7 to 3 o'clock shift. It isn't
Right.
just clock time, right? It's a shift time. And that's how they experience it. And my dad, he didn't mind 7 a.m., but 7 a.m. meant that the clock was going to start ticking about working. And he had a different view then of that unit of time because he was selling his labor doing it.
So there's a passage in this chapter that I think kind of really evocatively describes some of what you're talking about here. If you could turn to page 42 of your book, there's the paragraph that begins, "Workers still carried the effects."
Oh, yeah. And would you like me to read that paragraph?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'd be honored. Workers still carried the effects of previous jobs. Their bodies were stamped like passports from the labors they once did. Memories of past employment amounted to a cacophony of attitudes and opinions about working. Bits and pieces of past work accumulated in their minds informed them about what work is now and what it needed to be later. Driving a bus came after working in a factory. Working as a police officer came before being a teacher. For many workers, it was a job yesterday, a job today, and likely a job tomorrow. But others worked careers, or at least toward careers. Either way, workers held fresh in their consciousness the work and time before the jobs they were currently doing. Recalling previous labor served a clarifying purpose. Only holding firmly to the past while repairing an engine today cleared the mind to imagine a path towards where a worker wanted to be in life. Many workers summed up the utility and interdependent nature of their working careers this way. And now I'm quoting, "Work is what makes my life continue. Life begins and evolves through and because of work." Wow.
Yeah, it's beautifully said.
Thank you.
And there's a lot going on there too. The sense of work being carried in our bodies.
I think it's important to really understand the impressions in very physical ways, mental ways, psychological ways, emotional ways. We carry that labor, we carry that work, and we carry it with every job that we have. So it's not just in the bones that ache or in the muscles that are sore or in the tire that you feel or just the agingness that happens because of work. But there are memories that are carried. There's a psychological, I think, impact, both positive and negative, that is felt in the body. I mean, and I will often ask my students when we're talking about time and we're talking about work, I'll ask them, well, what works? When you say you work, what works? And we will get into the fact, well, my body works, mm-hmm. right? And that means you got to, well, okay, so what do you have to do to sort of keep your body healthy? What puts your body at risk? And what steps do you need to take? But what else works? Well, my mind works. All right. Well, your mind works in what ways? Well, I'm creative. I'm problem solving. Right. I'm figuring things out. Well, what else works? I'm angry. I'm pissed off. I'm frustrated. Or I'm happy. Man, I'm really feeling good. So obviously, your whole emotional self. And then there are folks who can find a kind of if you will, a soul, right? A spiritual sense that's also at play in the work that they do. So really, that body becomes the vehicle, really, in a complete way that is at work. Right. And they carry it with them everywhere.
So and that leads me to the second chapter where we talk about the idea of space and you explore this theme. How does space get constructed through the work that we do?
It's really impossible to be in any space that hasn't been worked up, right? The walls that surround us, the floors, even an outdoor space, the lawn, if you will, how we've maneuvered to create pathways, how preserves are just kept healthy, if you will. Every space that we occupy is a product of labor, a mixture of labor and nature. So it is the product of human labor that ends up getting congealed into inanimate objects, and that means in a very real literal sense, it is the work that builds the space that you occupy. But it also means that space begins to shape you, right? That you interact with the space that you're working in, and you learn to navigate it, right? You learn to compromise with it. It comes to shape you. You kind of know yourself, and I'm at home in my workspace, right? But it's also true that the landscape that you're a part of, and the the cityscape that you're a part of, the streetscape you're a part of, is all a product of labor. It's there, however, where you are hidden, so that you don't see the names of the workers, right? They're not on the building. You've got some brand that's on the building. And so workers are somewhat disappeared, and they're hidden from all of that space. And one interesting thing that I discovered when the book was finished is that the chapter on space was a bit longer than the other chapters, where the other chapters are somewhat comparable in size. This one was a little bit longer. And workers seem to really be thinking about living their life through their experiences with the spaces that they worked in, and how the spaces in their life came to symbolize or not the work that they did. So it had a bit of a outsized, impact, a little bit more impactful than even some of the other themes that resonated in the book.
Yeah, it's an interesting chapter, and you explore a variety of different ways that people experience the space of their work. I was really touched by the way that, people try to make a workspace their own, even when it is, even when, spaces that you don't think of being privatized, but they're trying to not just make it efficient, but to have a sense of identity there.
Well, they spend so much time there, and I'm reminded of things that I heard when I wrote my first book, Steelworker Alley, and stories that my father and other steelworkers told me about how when they finally did get locker rooms, and they didn't always have a locker room, you talk about a pretty barren space, but when they got lockers, they would turn them into places where they could socialize, mm-hmm. right? They would have little things. They would do things with their locker to make them feel actually a little bit more like they were at home, right? So they were bringing some of that home feeling and friendliness into the space. And you can think of office workers who have pictures of their family, or have a little trinket, or have something in that space that clearly has no real relevance to the to the work that they do, but they're bringing part of their how they would think of their non-work life right with them into that workspace, and And in doing that, I think they're also signifying that they feel they have a entitlement to the space, right? They've got some ownership. I know in a legal sense, it wouldn't be recognized, but in an experiential sense, in a felt sense, they feel some ownership in the spaces that they work in. And they feel more comfortable, and they take great pride in what they do, you know, what they do in that workspace.
It's interesting. I think several years ago, I read an editorial, I think maybe the Chronicle of Higher Education, that talked about how faculty don't adorn their doors anymore.
Huh.
And they said, you know, back in the day, and I really don't like that phrase, but, you know, at some time in the past, faculty would put something on the door of their office that said something about them, right? A political slogan or you know, mm-hmm. a piece of art, something that let you know about the person who was in there. And I think it's maybe a result of, you know, kind of the adjunctification of higher education, mm-hmm. that none of us really, even those of us who are tenured or tenure track, don't feel the same sense of ownership in the institutions anymore, and so don't bring that kind of personality into the space.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm thinking as you're talking, I have colleagues who teach in the labor studies program, and man, they've got all kind of
okay
political and social justice messages. We've got, you know, we've got phrases etched in the wall. I've got labor murals and framed posters from important labor stories like Big Strikes that are framed. There are images of labor leaders. There's images you know, sort of famous quotes about labor. So I haven't experienced that, but it, you know, maybe it goes from department to department. Maybe there's sort of a different kind of consciousness. Yeah. But certainly not amongst my labor studies brothers and sisters.
Well, that's good to know. So you call the third chapter Work's Impact. And here you look at different consequences of work, or to put it maybe a little more succinctly, the kinds of things that work creates or produces. So aside from the obvious answer, right, we go to work to produce whatever, what is work's impact?
Very multi-dimensional. So it literally determines how long you're going to live, right? And we talk about life expectancy and how it differs across various socioeconomic bands. It shapes how your body works because of the physical demands. It impacts a level of happiness and satisfaction and psychological comfort because of the stress and trauma that work can cause. It can also conversely bring great satisfaction to the individual, and can help at the end of the day create a sense of well-being, so that it can help to build our identity. It works impact can determine whether or not a child gets fed, right, or gets taken care of, or gets taught. The impact determines the road that gets built. Work's impact can determine whether there's a sense of cohesion, you know, whether we can learn to live together, whether you can build a healthy neighborhood and community. The impact of work is that we can learn to live with one another. Very often, you know, not all workplaces equally, but very often work becomes the most integrated part of our lives. So we need to fully appreciate both the, maybe to sum it up, both the life withering, and sort of life shortening and life denying impact of work, and also the life emboldering, the life giving, the life empowering nature of the work we do.
I think that's one of the things that I appreciated most about this book, and also found most frustrating, if I might say that, is
Please.
that I do a variety of podcast episodes where I talk to people about various labor and work related issues, and there's a significant school of thought that talks about some of the agonies of work, right? And all the way to the point of maybe we need to figure out some system of distributing social goods that's independent of actually doing work. And I'm sympathetic to that idea, right? But one of the beautiful things about this particular book, and I think your interactions with the students who, gave you the ideas here that are in it, is that work is more than just drudgery,
Yes.
right? Work's impact isn't just even though it is drudgery often, it's not just drudgery. And I wanted to let you know that I appreciated that about this book.
Well, I thank you. I recall the first feedback that I got from people who reviewed the manuscript, and I don't know, these people are anonymous. I'm assuming they're prominent people in my field, and they wrote extensively. I don't, of all the books I've written, I don't think I've ever gotten so many comments and questions and suggestions, but I'm really grateful to both of the reviewers. But I remember one of the comments, and this is to your point, where the reviewer said, the more you talk about the complexity, the more that you avoid saying the absolute thing, right? So it isn't, yes, Marx is right, there is alienation. That's true. But there's also this, and that's what your workers are telling you. And the more you avoid that, the more that you include that nuance, and you avoid sort of a one size fits all, or sort of a final definitive point, but just keep dealing in the most complex way as you can with the themes that you found, you're going to do, you're going to do more of a service to your reader. So, if one of those reviewers out there hears your podcast, I'm hoping they'll
So,
take great pleasure in what you've just said.
yeah, again, it's not just drudgery, but it's also joy. Or it is drudgery and it is also joy.
And it is also
It's a
joy.
both and, not an either or.
Yeah, I agree.
So one of the most challenging chapters of this book is where you take up the idea of purpose. In some ways, this seems like the most obvious of these chapters, but what emerges from the words of your students is some amazing nuance concerning the purpose of work. Describe for us how your students talked about what they see as the purpose of their work.
On one hand, and they're very clear-minded and very practical about it. They understand that if they don't work, they don't eat, and they talk about food. They talk about feeding as a metaphor. Really, it's a metaphor. It even comes up in some more religious-like responses with some workers. But they understand that there is this purpose to put food on the table, to make sure we have good health care. We can't live in this society well unless we choose to work, or we're fortunate enough to be part of that small percentage of people that doesn't live off the sweat of their brow. And so that's a purpose. For sure, but they're not just, and this in a chapter on the subject of work, but the purpose is also to build a future, and it's to invest in something, it's to make something better, it's to do something meaningful for them, both intrinsically and extrinsically, but to also do something meaningful and important for their family, for the people they love, for their, you know, for their neighbors, that work can fulfill a need to live this really, you know, meaningful life, a life that they have some agency over, that they've got some degree of control over, and it's this, you know, this blending of doing work because there are real needs that have to be met, and that's somewhat imposed because, you know, this is the state of the political economy in modern America in the 21st century, but also that you really do have larger aspirational goals. You want to do some good. You know, you want to leave some positive mark. You want tomorrow to be better than today, and you see yourself in a more holistic way, so that, you know, work's purpose is really to help to create a human life, you know, to be, you know, to have that human species really affirmed and empowered, and the only way to really live a fully human life is to do meaningful work. And to have less is to degrade, if you will, you know, the agency of a human being.
I think maybe it's in this chapter. I may not be recollecting this correctly, but where you say something along the lines of, you can take almost any ordinary object in our environment, and you know, look at underneath the surface of its ordinariness, there's just a tremendous amount of labor and interaction that goes into the creation of even the simplest things.
Well, actually, and I don't, yes, and I'm, and maybe an example that I know there's, I reference this in the book, but it's actually something that's fun to do in the class is very often somebody's holding a cup of coffee.
Right, that's the one.
Yeah, or maybe I'm holding a cup of coffee and I'll hold it up and I'll say, boy, you know, this cup of coffee is just outstanding. I need it, and I'll pause and I'll take a sip and they'll smile and laugh and say, man, this is so meaningful to me. And then I'll ask them, do you have any idea how much labor went into a cup of coffee? You know, let's talk about it. And they'll guess, well, you know, maybe it's 50 workers. Well, they say, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then they'll say, hey, wait a minute. How about the farm worker in Guatemala? Right. Let's kind of work this up. And then you got the truck driver bringing it here, and then it's being packaged. And then you got this young person, a barista at your favorite cafe, or maybe, you know, you're making it at home, and they hand you this and think about what this represents. Think about the complexity. Think about the logistics. Think about the hours of labor. Think about all of the interdependency that was necessary for me to have this moment of, you know, this moment of joy. And that's true of the hammer you're holding.
Sure.
Or if you're a teacher, it's true of the pen. Or if you're a nurse, it's, you know, it's a thermometer. And if you think of those objects that way, then I think you'll have an increased appreciation for the people who do that work. And then hopefully that will lead to treating all of those people, better. And you'll understand that, well, you know, the purpose of making that thermometer was to make sure that person gets better. And the purpose of the laptop and the microchip is because there's that kid on a Chromebook, you know, right, who's learning how to read. and where is that going to lead? So you can see the purpose of that work and the benefits that come from just the simplest, most mundane items in our life. Yeah, that's great that you that it left impression on you and that you called.
Absolutely. So, in the chapter called The Subject of Work, you describe, I think here, how work shapes our relationships. So what kinds of relationships are influenced by the work that people do?
All of them. Yeah, all of them. And some were just, or more overdeveloped than others. So the relationships we have, certainly with our with the people we work with, right? And now that we're doing more remote work, that may become a bit more tenuous, but there's still interaction. It may be coming via various virtual platforms. So there's obviously that, but there's also the relationship that you have with the people most immediate in your life, right? So if you're raising family, it would certainly would be children. If you're not raising family, but you have friends and people you love that you're in partnerships with, it helps to shape and make those relationships possible. It helps to feel, it helps to build a social relationship so that you are part of something greater. It kind of breaks out of the I self mentality, and there's more of a we and a collective sense that we did all of this, and we all have our part to play, and we come to have an appreciation for the people we do it for. I will say to my students that I really know nothing at all about how a car works. It's kind of amazing. I put my foot on the brake, I press a button, and lo and behold, it fires up.
Off it goes.
I have no idea. But I'm really grateful to those auto workers because they got me here. And because they did that work, I get to do what I do. And I love doing what I do. And I get to teach about them. So they don't know me, but I'll say to my students, I'm working for the auto workers. And they're working for me. They don't know me. We're anonymous to each other. And I think in many ways, there's a kind of intentional keeping apart of members, of the labor force, of the working class, so they don't build that sense of solidarity. But I'm working for them. They're working for me. I help to make their life possible. They help to make my life possible. And therefore, the subjects of our work really do break us by recognizing it. It breaks us out of our isolation, and we realize that we really are social beings. And I will ask workers, how many of you are out there working for yourself, right? And everybody's hand goes up, but I'll say, well, how many of you are only working for yourself? You're and now they and I'm not sure, but then far fewer hands go up. And we start exploring really where those relationships are coming from and how they're supported and fed and developed because of the work we do. And those relationships are they're intellectual relationships, they're emotional, they can be spiritual, they can obviously also be physical, and that they people share a life together. So it is important to it was really powerful to see workers in their essays really landing on the subject really of their work. And these five themes, keep in mind, I didn't ask workers, well, tell me, write me an essay about space. I didn't prefigure these themes. They just wrote essays. And these are the these were really five of the dominant themes that really seem to explain how they experience their life through their work.
So the conclusion of your book looks at the lessons that you learn from your students and then tries to project them a little bit into the future. So this is a really big question, What is the future of work, and how do you think it can be made to serve more humane ends?
Yeah, that is the big question, right?
Yeah.
And I've been working in this space around the future of work in other ways and other projects at the university. I direct a research center called the Project for Middle Class Renewal, and we've engaged in research around trying to understand a good job from a bad job, and what workers want to see in their work, and also trying to do that in the context of how the ways that we work are changing. And so, you know, the first thing I'd say is that in many ways, you know, work really hasn't changed that much. You know, most jobs don't require a lot of higher education, right? Most jobs aren't paying what they should pay. Most jobs have either too few hours or too many hours. Most workers really aren't working in satisfying positions, or they're not working for managers or employers who treat them as well as they should. And of course, people still, as we talked about earlier, they know they have to work, right? So one of the purposes of working is they have to earn a living to work. And at the same time, as we said, it isn't just drudgery. They do find meaning, and they do find a joy in what they do. So, you know, we know that we've got fewer workers who are working in manufacturing settings than we once did, although there's certainly a chance with electric vehicles and other kinds of battery production that manufacturing is going to come up. We know now that workers need more education than their brothers and sisters did decades ago, certainly than my father and mother did. But we're still going to be in settings where the vast majority of people that are working are selling their labor, right? They're going to have to, they're not going to own the operations, and they're going to have to live on their labor. And it's going to be wages and salaries that are going to provide for them. And the hope of the book is that if we really appreciated how important labor was to all of us, that we would design policies and create institutions that would be more responsive to dignified and humane work. So, for example, there's no reason to stick with the 40-hour work week. We should give that up. We could do just as much in a 32-hour week, 40 hours of pay. We should reduce the amount of overtime that workers have to work. A lot of workers work the overtime because their hourly normal wages just aren't high enough. There should be some, you know, ways we should raise the minimum wage to a living wage. We should have laws that enable more workers to join unions. All of the survey research says that we'd have a much higher percentage of workers who would be in unions if it wasn't such a difficult and risky thing to do.
Hard to be in sometimes after even you've joined one.
Yeah. Look, they're right. These are institutions made up of human beings that are functioning. Yeah,
I'm the chief negotiator in our contract talks with the university administration this summer. So it's
Well, I have a lot of respect and admiration for you stepping into that role. And it's a small percentage of people that actually then take on the leadership roles of these really important institutions. We ought to have a political party system where working class views really are front and center, not an afterthought. You know, they're not just an addendum to a party platform, but we genuinely have the role of work and the importance of work at the center of the policies that we implement. The people that we, elect to office, my workers just roll their eyes and shake their heads at the way the media represents them. And there's been some good, really good press, really since the fall of 2021 and increase of labor strikes and actions. There's really been some pretty good press, but there are very, 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 very few standard labor beat reporters at major newspapers. So something around the public representation of workers really needs to change. And about all of these are ideas that they surface up in the class. They all recognize that, with the exception of the class that they are in with me, there may be some others that they've taken, they don't recall really talking about work or talking about organized labor or talking about the labor management relationship or talking about American capitalism in any of the classes that, that they took. And by the way, there aren't a whole lot of these labor study programs in higher education. I mean, our program is really one of the, it's a very large one. It's very successful, but it's an exception, to the rules. So they're, so they wonder, we should be doing a better job educating young people about the workplace. We should be, and not because you, and it's not what, it's not what the business community wanted throughout the 20th century. It's not about turning all of these folks into widget right. turners. No, that's not what I mean. That's not what they mean. They mean, let's talk about the realities. Let's talk about the power imbalance. Let's talk about what work's going to do to you. Let's talk about what you want in your labor, and therefore, what should you do in your life to protect yourself and protect your work and make sure that work is more dignified. There's no reason why we should subject workers to having to have a really effective union to bargain some health care. I mean, yeah. It's not, they seem to figure this out in other countries. Yeah. Why can't we figure it out here? It doesn't make sense not to have paid parental leave or paid time off from work. And, we ought to have far more health and safety inspectors working in government to make sure that we work in safe places. So, that's one of the things they came up in the chapter on space is how dangerous the place can be. So, and so across all of these dimensions, I find that workers were really quite practical and quite reasonable. They really weren't looking, to end American capitalism, right? But man, they really wanted it fair. They wanted significantly reformed, and they believed that that would create a healthier society. And it's where I got a chance actually to reference one of my favorite philosophers, and that was Aristotle, because Aristotle could speak to the idea of a mean that is, not too much,
right.
but enough, right? And not deficient, but not an extreme. And so you find your virtues and you find the right sort of place to land on all of those virtues. And if we took very serious, I think, what Aristotle was speaking to in his virtues, his virtue ethics, we would end up with healthier workplaces. And I found that my workers really understood that philosophy sure. without ever having to read, any classic, Greek philosophy.
Well, and again, I just want to thank you for this book. I think if, you mentioned politics, if our political candidates would actually hear the voices of the workers speaking through your work, I think if they were open to it, maybe some minds would be changed, because the people who you quote and the things that you're writing about here when discussing what people are actually saying about the things that they do for a living, they're just so important for us to understand.
Well, Tom, I'm grateful that you gave me this time to talk about the work. And if if one person with means, power, and influence was positively affected by the words here, and made life a little bit more beautiful for the working class, then that would be that would be a great outcome of the work. So thank you.
So before I let you go today, this is kind of a loaded question given everything that we've talked about. But I'd like to finish up by asking, what are you working on next?
Oh, well, that's cool that you asked that, right? So I'm loving the opportunity to talk about the current book, but so I keep doing these essays, right? And I keep reading other things, and I'm wondering, well, what else is emerging? And I'm thinking a little bit about, so this is what work is, but I'm wondering about how workers think about what work entitles them to. Like, how does work situate them in the world? So maybe there's an so it isn't what work is, but some derivation on a similar title, a kind of a second volume that speaks to other ways that workers experience work. And maybe it's going to take a little tweak in the writing exercise. And I will also note, since you asked, I am working with colleagues at the university on a really large survey in which we've asked workers about their job quality. And so we hope to release sometime in the fall a pretty impactful study about the subjective voice from the subjective voices of workers, how they define a good job from a bad job, and what they need in a job in order for it to be a high quality job. So thanks for asking.
Well, no, thank you. So again, thanks for taking the time to talk today. Really appreciate hearing from you. And again, my thanks for the book. It's really terrific.
Thank you, Tom. Meant a lot to be with you. Appreciate it.
So once again, my guest today has been Robert Bruneau, the author of What Work Is, from the Working Class in American History series of the University of Illinois Press. My name is Tom DeSena, and you have been listening to the New Books Network.